this morning about the plagues that preach, and this comes from, Exodus 6:8 is our main verse we're going to be reading today. But really, to cover the plagues, we have to start back at chapter 4 and go through chapter 10. So we're going to be covering quite a bit there in chapter 4 through chapter 10. So if you turn there with me, please. You know, the Bible says, lean not on your own understanding. And we do have some folks here who have claimed that as a favorite verse, a favorite Bible verse. To trust in the Lord and lean not on our own crutches, our own devices to get things done. That God is the one who accomplishes things for us. And I do believe that one way that we can lean not on our own understanding and trust in the Lord is by trusting in other people. And you say, well, there's not really many that I can trust, Tony. You know, I always turn to the Lord. I don't turn to others because I often get bad advice. But I am suggesting here this morning that there are some godly counselors here among us. And they, when asked, impart biblical wisdom. And of course, that's what we should be seeking, is godly wisdom. And that normally comes through godly people. And godly people are usually those who've lived a little bit and have spent some time in dealing with certain facets of life that maybe we haven't dealt with yet. And as a result, we dip into their counsel. We ask them some questions because chances are they've already had the benefit of that burning bush that we're now looking at. Any burning bush experiences here this morning? I'm not asking for a show of hands. But I am saying this, that there are often times in life where God is speaking to us through a burning bush and we are not even aware, even though we are struck by the peculiar way in which the counsel is given. And we say, is that bush speaking to me? Gee, it is burning so brightly and it the bush doesn't seem to be consumed. The branches are still intact and that's kind of strange. And maybe I ought to be listening to what's being said. Well, as we consult those godly counselors in our lives, they have, by most means anyway, encountered some burning bush experience in their existence. And they've heard God's voice. Now, I'm not suggesting that they're going to know where you're coming from. I'm not going to say that they understand what God has said to you. But I am saying this. I am saying that the direction that you're facing in your life is one that they have already traveled. At least there's a good chance that they have. They said, yes, brother, I've already been through that. Sister, I can tell you this. I've encountered that at one point in my life, and here's how I dealt with it. And now you seem to be talking about a whole new set of plans in your life. No matter what age you are, you have faced, maybe in the past couple of days or past couple of weeks or past couple of months, a burning bush experience. And there are some major changes in your life that are taking place. And they seem rather upsetting to you. Because life was going along just fine, and now you're somewhat troubled by the new circumstances, and you're even unsettled by them. You might even be frightened by the new circumstances that are taking place in your life. And for those who care about you, who really care about you, they're going to say, I've been through what you're experiencing. I've not gone through exactly what you're going through, but I have gone through similar circumstances. And they're not going to know everything you know about the process that God is leading you in right now. But I am saying that they do have some expertise on the subject. So we understand those biblical counselors for who they are, godly men and women in our lives who have made a difference that we've enjoyed talking to over the years, that have really led us in some of the right ways that we've gone and enjoyed and have been blessed by. And we've gone back to thank them and say, you know, because of your counsel, I have done this, I've strayed from that, and I know where I'm going now. Well, I want to give that this morning, and that's going to kind of be our beginning. But let's read here at verse number 18 of chapter 4. If you'd go to chapter 4 with me in the book of Exodus, I want to begin reading at verse number 18. So Exodus 4:18 is where we're starting. Now, we're going to cover quite a bit of ground, and this is ground you're familiar with. So I'm not going to leave anybody here in the dust this morning. There's not going to be anybody who leaves here today who's going to say, man, he went so fast, I don't know where he was going. And I don't know where he ended up. This is all familiar territory. So you're going to be very assured of what I'm saying here today. Verse 18, chapter 4. Moses went back to Jethro, his father-in-law. This is after the burning bush experience. And he said to him, "Let me go back to my own people in Egypt to see if any of them are still alive." Jethro said, "Go, I wish you well." Now the Lord had said to Moses in Midian, "Go back to Egypt, for all the men who wanted to kill you are dead." So Moses took his wife and his sons and put them on a donkey and started back to Egypt. And he took the staff of God in his hand. Let's go ahead and stop there. One thing that I would say to you today is that as you read on, you'll find where this plan really flowed. I mean, this journey to Egypt that Moses took his family on was really off on the right footing. Because, you see, Moses was God's personal concern. God had his hand on Moses, and Moses never disappeared from the thinking of God. God was always aware of the welfare of Moses. But I can imagine most any person who is here today would scratch your head over verse 21. I want to read verse 21. After all that's been said, where God says, "I will deliver the Israelites from the hand of the Egyptians, and it'll be you, Moses, who is doing it." Actually, I'm doing it, he says, "but you will be my agent in doing this." Look at verse 21. Here's where things become difficult. You know, we've had some discussions with family members over this, and you probably have too. Here's what it says. "When you return to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders that I have given you the power to do. But I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go." All right, so God is going to send Moses on this journey to deliver the Israelites from the hand of the Egyptians, but God is going to make the hearts of those Egyptians, namely Pharaoh, extremely hard so that Moses will be unsuccessful in this attempt. Now, who would want to tackle an assignment like that? When God gives you a forewarning that those that you're appearing to are going to say no to you. What if we knew that going in? Would we tackle the assignment? There's probably a good chance we'd say, "Not me, Lord," as we talked about last week. We gave all the excuses as to why, when God calls us, we're not going to do what he says. But here's that verse 21, and it's printed out so very, very loudly, it rings throughout the pages of the book of Exodus. But God gives Moses these specific instructions on what to say. Look at verse 22. Verse 22 says, "Here's what the Lord says, 'Israel is my firstborn, and I told you, let my son go, so that he may worship me. But you refuse to let him go, so I will kill your firstborn son in return.'" Israel is God's firstborn son. Remember Jacob, his name was changed to Israel. Israel is the nation now that is considered God's firstborn. "Let my firstborn go, but since you will not do that, I am going to kill your firstborn." What lessons do we learn here? Is there anything that we can learn here from this? I think if there's any lesson to learn, I think it's that we live our lives in availability to God's will, and we're not leaning on our own understanding. We're not trying to figure things out on our own. We're saying, "God, I'm not even going to pretend to know where you're going with this, but in obedience to your will, I will carry it out." You simply touch the keyboard of service, and presto, you become the hands of God. You become the feet of God. You become the voice of God. I mean, isn't that wonderful that you don't have to figure it all out? You just say, "God, give me the words to speak. God, give me the legs to move and the hands to touch. And I'm not going to take this assignment lightly. I'm available to you." So you imagine yourself now walking into Pharaoh's court, knowing full well what his response is going to be to you, but you're going to go in anyway. This is a man that we normally wouldn't mess with, but God told us to, so we're going to do it. So you come to him with a decent proposal, and this proposal, as I say, is decent simply because it's not asking Pharaoh of that much. It's asking that the people of Israel can leave the hard, cruel labor of Egypt and go off for 3 days and worship the Lord in the wilderness. That's really the only proposal that was given. But your high hopes for a quick exodus begin to crumble, and you plead your case with Pharaoh, and you say, "Pharaoh, yeah, in all your majesty, why do you deal with us this way? I mean, we're only asking for this. We're not asking for much. Why is your heart so hard? I mean, you do things in the right way. You do exactly what God tells you to do. You're obeying him to the fullest. You're using God's very own words, and still you come out empty-handed. You come out nowhere." And you say, "Well, that was certainly worth the effort, wasn't it?" and nothing takes place as a result. Well, now here's our key verse. It's verse number 8 of chapter 6. It says this, it says, I will bring you to the land that I swore with uplifted hand to give you to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob. I will give to you as a possession. I am the Lord. That's our key verse. Makes me wonder if Moses ever got tired of hearing this. But I think we have a long time in coming before maybe that happens, where Moses says, okay, I'm through hearing that. You keep giving me this promise, these reminders. But listen, when is this going to come to be? When is it going to happen? I'm becoming very impatient. Well, in any case, at least here, he takes this word of encouragement back to the Israelites. I think it's encouraging to me, and I think it's encouraging to you here today, that the God that we serve, the God that we enjoy, the God that we love and obey, has a circumstance of ideal working conditions. You know what God's ideal working conditions are? I think we need to be reminded of this often. He's saying to us, come on. He's saying to us, kick back a little bit for crying out loud. You deserve a break. He's saying, let me take care of it. Why are you trying to take care of what is mine to take care of to begin with? He says, when are you going to get that through your head? And still we go on about life saying, God, I will take care of it. God, I know I'm giving it to you, but I'm going to take care of a little bit as well. How do you think Moses felt here when God had reminded him of this? I mean, to hear these same words over and over. I'm taking care of it. You don't have to worry. You sit back. You'll be my instrument, my tool, but I am the one who's doing it. How often do you think that God told this to Moses before he began to say, yes, God, but... Yes, God, but you see, you have to remember that the situation that you're facing in life is never out of control. It's never beyond God's reach where he's saying, you know, my son, my daughter, I don't know what to do anymore. I've tried everything. My resources are exhausted. I really don't know what to do. God is not saying that to us at all. He's saying, I have everything under control. I am the Lord. Isn't that what he said to Moses? I am the Lord. Right now, I am the Lord. Now, God chose to allow this for whatever reason, and for whatever reason in your life, He chooses to allow whatever is happening with you. And you say, God, when is this going to be taken care of? When is this going to be fixed? And God says, trust not in your own understanding. Trust in the wisdom of godly counselors who are there amongst you, who have experienced what you're experiencing, maybe not to the exact, but close to it. But then he says, more importantly of all, trust in me. I will work this out. You know, as a result, you become very dependent upon your Lord. Oh, to become dependent upon our Lord. We're so, I suppose, self-preserved, you know as well as I do. We take care of things on our own because it proves toughness. When did toughness ever prove itself in total dependency? Isn't that a sign of weakness, really? Isn't it weakness on our part to say, I have no answers whatsoever, I can accomplish absolutely zero on my own, except for God? Does that show weakness? Maybe by a human standpoint, it certainly does. But I'll tell you, as we're humbled, and God allows us to be humbled, it's so that we're dependent upon Him, and we allow Him to take the reins and run it, and we simply say, listen, I'm only on the very back of God's, God's direction, God's wherever He's going, whatever He's doing. So we wait upon the one who was, who is to come, the one who's yet to be. I mean, in this case, God's promises to the nation of Israel were a new era of kingdom life. And that kingdom life was the one in which Jesus Christ would eventually serve as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And they may not have understood that at the time. But God would not forget His people. And God had His people in mind all throughout the books of the Old Testament up until the time of Christ. And He created a new nation. It was a spiritual nation, a nation of Christians making up the church. You know, we are the bride of Christ. And the Israelites who were living way back in the day could not see that. Except as Hebrews talks about when they looked from afar, really standing on tiptoes and trying to see far into the future as to what God was going to do. The things that you're hoping to come to pass may not happen in your lifetime, but God will bring them to pass. Pharaoh had a stubborn heart. Stubborn people. Stubborn people are difficult to deal with. We don't get very far with stubborn people. There's an old saying, though, that you got to fight poison with poison. Right? You've heard that? Well, certainly. In other words, if you're going to deal with those who are bullheaded, sometimes you got to be equally determined. Sometimes you got to be bullheaded. I'll tell you what my problem is a lot of times is I give up too easily. You know, I come across a bullheaded or stubborn person, I say, well, maybe it's just not meant to be, and I kind of let it go. But if it's something I really believe in, something I want to fight for, I need to be bullheaded and stubborn. And I think you do too. There are times in your life where maybe you need to fight poison with poison. Let's go to the seventh chapter now, and let's read verses 14 through 16. Well, we'll save that for later. 14 through 16, chapter 7 of Exodus. Here's what it says. The Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh's heart is unyielding. He refuses to let the people, Israel, go. Go to Pharaoh in the morning as he comes out to the water. Wait on the bank of the Nile to meet him and take in your hand that staff that was changed into a snake. And then say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has sent me to you. Let my people go so that they may worship me in the desert. But until now, you've not listened. That's through verse 16. So we have the whole nation here. The whole nation that's about to suffer, the whole nation, Israel, that is working under the cruel hand of the Egyptians. And because of calloused hearts like Pharaoh's, that nation continues to suffer. And Moses, who's one of them, says, listen, I can't stand around and take this anymore. I don't want to see my people suffer as they've suffered. Well, Pharaoh says, that's tough. You know, and he continues to thumb up his nose, does he not? Or defy the Israelite nation, which brings about what we know of as God's very first plague. And this very first plague is one of 10. And each one builds with momentum and they get stronger. And the very first one is the plague of blood. Now, I want to tell you this. We're not going to read it. It'd take us a good bit of the morning to read through this entire thing. But do you realize that up until this point, the Egyptians' diet was fresh water and fresh fish? Where do fish live? In water. And the water is turned into blood. What a terrible thing God has done. But God is trying to get his point across here. I mean, this fish provided nourishment for the families of the Egyptians, and now it is all gone. And you better believe that that caused some stress. And that caused all kinds of difficulty along the land of Egypt. Except for the small amounts of water that were contained in homes, there was none available. So the water was dried up. It had turned into blood. And now we read in verse 24 of that seventh chapter these words. The Egyptians dug around the Nile to get drinking water because they could not drink the water of the river. Well, that's plague number one. Still, Pharaoh had a hard heart and did not let the Egyptians go. Plague number two was the plague of the frogs. Wall-to-wall croakers. You know, the Lord told the Egyptians, the Nile is going to swarm with frogs, chapter 8, verse 3. Now, if we skip to verse 15, look at verse 15 with me of this eighth chapter. It says that Pharaoh saw that there was relief. In other words, God removed the frogs because Pharaoh, guess what he did? He told the Lord that, okay, if you'll remove the frogs, I will let the people go. God removed the frogs, and Pharaoh hardened his heart. Well, now there's relief, verse 15, and then it says here that he hardened his heart against Moses and Aaron, just as God had said. Should this surprise anyone? No, it should not, because God said from the very beginning he was going to harden the heart of Pharaoh. Even with the suffering of his people, Pharaoh's heart remained as tough as leather. These Egyptians were probably wanting to say to Pharaoh, oh, come on, lighten up. They're not asking for that much. I mean, we can't stand this water being turned into blood, and now the frogs that are in everywhere, even in our frying pans, as we're getting ready to cook supper. I've heard that if you put a frog in a frying pan and you turn up the temperature, I think you've heard this, if you turn it up ever so slightly, he will cook right there in the frying pan. If you turn it up quickly, of course, he'll jump out. But if you turn it up slowly, he's good for dinner. And as it happened, God hardened Pharaoh's heart. This was the second plague of the Lord, the second plague that he had bestowed upon Pharaoh and his company. Yeah, that's right. Plague number three, the plague of gnats. Look at verse 17, chapter 8. Throughout all the land of Egypt, gnats as thick as dust. I think it says there, if you look at it, it says that out of the dust became gnats. Has anyone here, raise your hand, ever been allergic to dust? All right, well, we got a couple, don't we? You get allergic to dust and you start sneezing and carrying on and so on. You know, dust is really everywhere. I mean, on a sunny day, you can open the curtains and you can just see as you look through the sunbeams as the sun comes in through the window, you can see dust particles everywhere. It's there, isn't it? I mean, dust is everywhere. I mean, really. If you've been allergic to dust, you must be allergic to air, because dust is in the air. And anyway, the Egyptians found themselves under the black cloud of gnats. It's just so thick. You know, I lived in Florida, as you know, for many years, and when the orange groves were out in the summertime, the gnats were just terrible. You ever been there in the summertime? Really awful. But you know what? When the orange groves died out because of the recent freezes in the last 20 years, 30 years, you know, many of those orange groves have died out, and they've been replaced by, guess what? Homes. Now there are homes everywhere in Florida. No more orange groves. And now it's houses. Everywhere you look, there are houses. Houses make up neighborhoods. No more pretty groves because they've frozen off. But the good news is, no more orange groves, no more gnats. And you know what? That's a pretty wonderful thing. Because in the summertime, it would become quite unbearable with gnats. Gnats are awful. Gnats are terrible. But they were ever there. I mean, black clouds, it says, of gnats. But the Israelites, from the fourth plague on, enjoyed divine protection. And that's wonderful. Let's go on to plague four. It's the plague of the insects. There's the plague of the insects. Insects are everywhere. They're in your cereal. They're in your fruit cup. They're on your hands. And insects. Insects are no good. Night after night, day after day, insects. And with each of these plagues through the first four, Pharaoh says, remove them. Now, some of them, he didn't say, remove them and I will let the people go. But there are occasions in the first four where he said, listen, my heart is hard, but I will let the people go, only to harden it again and say, your people cannot go. Plague number five is the plague on livestock. That meant where all the Egyptians' cattle would die, all the Israelites' cattle would live. Then the plague of the boils. The boils is plague number six. And I've never lived with boils. I have no idea what that's like. Some have experienced shingles, and they say that may be an experience that might be similar to that. But boils hurt, don't they? Boils are very, very painful on the skin. And they were all over those who have them, those of the Israelites who had them. So we ask, what else could happen? Well, there's more. The plague of hail, plague number seven. Hail, as it says here in chapter 9, verse 23, it says that Moses stretched out his staff toward the sky, and the Lord sent thunder and terrible hail. But the worst was yet to come. Plague number eight, and nine for that matter. Locusts and darkness. No pun intended. But this is a dark chapter in the history of Egypt. You know, it really is. I mean, this darkness was so thick you could feel it. You know, I've watched Scooby-Doo. Come on. I've watched Scooby-Doo as a child. I've watched it as an adult. And I have seen where Shaggy and Scooby try to drill through the darkness because it's so thick and they can reach right through. And that's how dark it was here. It was extremely dark. And that's what these Egyptians were experiencing. And this finally led to the dramatic confrontation described in the 28th chapter of the book of Exodus, 28th verse, rather, of the book of Exodus, chapter 10. Much hinges on this. And, we got to take another week for this one. We do, because it's time to quit. But the fact of the matter is, this is another sermon unto itself. Look at verse 28, chapter 10. Well, let's back up to 27. The Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. He was not willing to let them go. This was after the plague of darkness. Then verse 28, here is a very important verse in the book of Exodus. Pharaoh said to Moses, "Get out of my sight. Make sure you do not appear before me again. The day you see my face is the day you will die." Verse 29, just as you say, Moses replied, "I will never appear before you again." You see, Pharaoh by this time was fed up and was determined to let the people go. But the fact of the matter is, there's more to it than this. Because we get into the plague of the firstborn. We'll spend a whole sermon on that next week. The plague of the firstborn, which is the 10th plague, which is the awfulest plague of all. Well, I just want to say this in closing. Think what it's like to stiffen your neck and to harden your heart. You know, there are many applications we could make from this, absolutely. And this is not the only one that I'm sharing with you now. It really is not. But think what it's like to harden your heart, to go your own way, to become so stubborn when God is trying to do something that you say no. It's not going to happen. I'm not going to let it happen. I'm going to make sure that it doesn't happen. Now, does God harden our heart for that occasion so that he can show his majesty and his glory? Maybe. But I know our hearts get hard at times. I know that we become very stubborn. I mean, Pharaoh enjoyed the great favor of God, the grace of God. I mean, life was going on well. Pharaoh had everything to his choosing. Yes, he was oppressing the Israelites by making them work so hard. But Pharaoh really had things pretty good at this time. Think about the times when you have enjoyed God's great grace and favor. But what started out as a temporary high or an artificial high was soon replaced by your getting on your knees and begging God for his forgiveness and pleading with God for a new start that you've taken for granted his grace and his favor, and you've become so stubborn and you've not listened and you've rebelled against the Lord. And he prompts all of us. He makes things so difficult to where we really have no choice anymore but to get on our knees and plead for his favor and his grace. Pharaoh was definitely a tool of Satan, but he was also a tool of God. We claim to be tools of God, but sometimes I wonder if we're not playing into the devil's hands when we're stubborn, when we go our own way, when we stiffen our neck, as Pharaoh did. Well, that's where we're going to leave it today. Let's pick it up next week and enjoy it some more from the life of